This call is being recorded.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Groundings Podcast. I'm your host, Devin Springer, and I have with me today a guest who for several months I have been trying to make time to interview, and I'm so glad we're finally getting the chance. And it feels like it's happening at a very urgent and sort of necessary and relevant time as well. I have with me Rebecca Pierce. Rebecca is a filmmaker, photographer, writer as well. If you haven't seen her short documentary, No Man's Land, you should just go on YouTube right now and watch it. I'll make sure to link it in the description. But before we get into the interview, I'm going to let Rebecca go ahead and introduce herself. So, Rebecca.
Hey, so like Devin said, I'm a Black and Jewish documentary filmmaker. I also do a lot of different types of multimedia work focused on trying to bring something of like an intersectional lens to how we talk about Israel and Palestine, connecting issues of anti-Black racism, issues of Israel's internal apartheid system between Jewish people to the struggle for Palestinian liberation, and helping to kind of demystify the role of Zionism and white supremacy in the Jewish community.
Your own identity as someone who's both Black and Jewish, in my opinion, from reading and watching your work, it kind of frames a lot of your work and your storytelling in the sense that, one, it's this identity intersection or connection or whatever you want to call it that is a little bit underexplored as opposed to others. And two, you know, you're sort of at the nexus of two separate but also connected oppressions or types of racism or violence or however you want to word it. So can you talk about how your own identity of being both Black and Jewish has impacted your work just across the spectrum from your art to your activism and everything else in between?
Definitely. So just coming from like a, you know, mixed race and interfaith family, I grew up with just the perspective of these, like you were saying, two different but also connected forms of oppression, like whether we're talking about the history of anti-Black racism in this country or, you know, anti-Semitism. Both of those things were things that I was raised to be really conscious and aware of from an early age, you know, and experience how these things can affect your life materially from a really young age. And for me, this has made, you know, just solidarity with different struggles for, you know, social, racial, economic justice really a natural thing that I'm drawn to. The connection between both of these issues is the history of white supremacy, of Christian supremacy, you know, these really very old questions of who belongs in a society, who doesn't belong, whose culture is allowed, whose culture is forced underground. Yeah, so for me, I'm always trying to make these connections and search for the answers to those questions because they're fundamentally the questions that frame, you know, my life and the life of my ancestors on both sides of my family.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about anti-Semitism, it's a sentiment and a form of white supremacist thought that an action that has in many ways manifested in the Black community. Mm-hmm. And then vice versa, I think that anti-Black racism has manifested in the non-Black Jewish community in various ways. You know, to me, it's similar to sort of being Afro-Latino, right? Or these various sort of meshing of identities. And what I'm getting at is your article that sort of connects the recent mass shooting at a synagogue in Pittsburgh to the shooting in a Kroger parking lot that killed two elderly Black people. Again, I'll link this article in the description of the episode. It's incredibly well written and it's heartfelt and it feels very personal, but also important. You talk about these two instances not being distinct, but deeply connected. So can you just talk about that article a little bit and sort of why you chose to write this article, placing these two instances together?
So for me, the pain I felt around Pittsburgh was the same pain that I felt around the Kroger shooting. And I think for both the Black and Jewish community, we carry so much of our knowledge and our survival tactics and our hope from things that are passed down to us from our elders. So to lose them in these really painful, horrible acts of white supremacist violence, it's a special kind of pain, a special kind of trauma. And so for me, it brought up a lot. It brought up, you know, the loss of my own grandfather. Also things that I didn't mention in the article, like the fact that his father had also been killed, the loss of Jewish elders in the Holocaust, and how we don't have these relationships anymore, it really hurts us and it hurts our struggles. But also just because these people are gone doesn't mean that we can't continue to carry on the lessons that they've taught us. And I think, you know, the Pittsburgh shooting was this case of this man who was obsessed with the idea that Jews are bringing refugees and immigrants into the United States. It's this anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that's tied to this idea that, you know, Jewish money is influencing global politics in a way that is harming the, you know, the sanctity of the white race, right? And in the case of the Kroger shooting, you had this guy who intended to target a black church. So it could have actually been even a much more similar crime to Pittsburgh than what we ended up seeing. He also spared the life of a white man who pulled a gun on him because he said whites don't shoot each other. And both of these instances were connected to this idea of preserving a, you know, a whites-only nation that has, you know, kind of settler fantasy that never really existed in America, but it's also kind of foundational to how we understand, you know, white American identity from a white supremacist perspective. And so for me, these two instances of anti-Semitic and anti-Black violence, which were tied into also anti-immigrant violence, had a really salient connection that needed to be discussed. And I was a little disappointed to see how, you know, sometimes in the Jewish community, people weren't bringing up the Kroger shooting as much. It's not true of everyone, but in some spaces where I was looking for comfort, I remember thinking, why is no one talking about this as well? So it was really important for me to make that connection and also to talk about not just the politics of what happened, but the personal and communal loss that both these communities experienced. Because I think we need to process these things and really face that pain if we're going to survive and hopefully outlive this fascist uprising that we're seeing in the U.S. and around the world.
So I guess my question for you is, how do we keep these two events connected and in conversation with each other authentically, right, in ways that build solidarity that aren't just merely symbolic? And are there historical sort of precedents or examples that we can use to do that?
Yes, that's a really good question. I think in any situation of organizing community, we need to be working from authentic relationships and not just, you know, it's not enough to sort of like string these things together and say they're connected. We have to do a lot more to build and do intercommunal work that can be really difficult sometimes. There is a lot of history of collaboration between the Black and Jewish community. Some of that is mythologized in a way that I think is unhelpful, but there's a lot to dig into and look at historically. There were Jewish folks involved in the civil rights movement. I think we shouldn't see these folks as saviors, but in certain cases, people who are willing to, along with Black folks, give up their lives and struggle for freedom. That's a really powerful thing to work from. When we're talking about the martyrs of Mississippi Summer and these kinds of things, that's a really strong and powerful history to work from. There's also, in terms of the way our communities have been framed and demonized, a lot of similarities and a lot of connections that we can be working from. The sort of right-wing kind of meme of cultural Marxism is really rooted in this idea, like an older idea, sort of blaming Jewish communists for helping to incite Black organizing, which is, of course, kind of offensive myth for a lot of reasons, in part because Black people didn't need anyone else to tell us that we needed to get free. But it also speaks to like the reality of strong leftist traditions that we have in both communities that are deeply connected that we can work from. So I think that that's really important. We also have to kind of face the difficulties and the tensions that come up. You know, you're mentioning earlier, there's anti-Semitism in the Black community. There's also definitely anti-Blackness in the Jewish community. So we need to wrestle with these things and also realize that both of them come from a sort of internalized oppression. For me, like the anti-Semitism I've experienced in the Black community has been really rooted in a kind of Christian hegemony, the forced, you know, Christian hegemony that comes from slavery, and a sort of view of Jewish people that is rooted in how European Christians view Jewish people and not how Jewish people have actually seen ourselves and operated in the world. In terms of anti-Blackness in the Jewish community, it's a kind of an attempt to like latch on to the conditional whiteness that is afforded to a lot of Jewish folks and separate ourselves from the other. And it's also about really taking this fear and insecurity that Jewish people have lived with, you know, in Europe and Middle East and a lot of places for a long time, and putting that onto folks who are structurally very oppressed in this country and not onto the forces of, you know, white supremacy and hegemony that really were the foundations of the oppression that we experienced. So I think we really have to face all of these things, both our really exciting and lesser known like shared history, and also the need to address the real tensions that exist that are a product of the way white supremacy stratifies people.
You mentioned at one point as well, sort of the using anti-Black racism as a way to lean into a white identity, mm-hmm. and as well as sort of exploiting fear or past trauma in some instances. A friend of mine, Adam Horowitz, over at Mondo Weiss, wrote mm-hmm. a piece titled "The Israeli Government is Exploiting the Pittsburgh Murders to Try to Demonize Palestinian Solidarity." And I think that's like an important point I want to ask you about is from the Pittsburgh shooting, I think that it sort of increased and altered the way a lot of very conservative Jewish pundits are talking about Israel now, where this tragedy has sort of been wrapped in the language of this is why you should support Israel, or did this person have connections to BDS? And similarly, I think that it's this exploitation of a tragedy for a political agenda, no matter what side it's coming from. After a lot of shootings, mass shootings, we also see the same thing done by the Democrats for these very liberal, horribly calculated gun control laws, right? Mm-hmm. Where void of any kind of cohesion of identity or how these gun control laws will affect Black communities or poor communities or et cetera, or self-defense, right? But nonetheless, it's tragedies being exploited. So in the instance of the Pittsburgh shooting and the Kroger shooting, did you feel that there were sort of marginal voices that were attempting or who still are to kind of exploit that tragedy?
Yeah, so in the aftermath of the Pittsburgh shooting, Naftali Bennett, who's the diaspora minister in Israel, came to the United States. He's a really right-wing, very dangerous politician. In his remarks, he was immediately trying to make a connection between what had happened in Pittsburgh and Palestinians. And a lot of people in the Pittsburgh community and like the Jewish community in the U.S. were really bothered by this and spoke out against it, which I thought was really important. But yeah, you've also seen even people like Cory Booker supporting an anti-BDS legislation in the United States on the basis, or saying that this is somehow in solidarity with Pittsburgh or because of Pittsburgh. And so people, are really, in certain cases, trying to make this false connection between what was a white right-wing, white supremacist terrorist attack on Jewish people worshiping with unarmed or nonviolent tactics that are being employed like BDS by Palestinians to advocate for their rights. And so this is a really dangerous false connection to make for a lot of reasons. And it's also completely selling out the victims of this horrible tragedy who were killed by someone who was very clear about what his agenda was. And it was to stop what he saw as Jewish people bringing refugees into this country. Yeah, we definitely need to be calling these things out and paying attention to them. And when you talk about the other mass shootings and this kind of knee-jerk sort of gun control reaction where people are not looking at what, increased criminalization does in this country and who it targets. It's a different but definitely connected sort of issue here where, like, till we look at the foundational issues of all of these crimes and why this violence is happening, it's really rooted in American white supremacy and settler colonialism, we can't actually face these issues. And so more gun control without looking at why these shootings are happening isn't going to help us. In the case of, I have folks in my family who were locked up because cops planted a gun on them and they were able to exploit these laws that are already in existence. So what mm-hmm. we're going to end up with is just further entrenching the same systems of oppression that got us to this place where people are being shot in these horrible crimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's the aspect that is definitely unpopular to say, but has to be looked at. This sort of material and nuance point where you say, look, we understand the need that America might be the only country in the world where there's more guns than people on the streets. But at the same time, we have to understand, like you just said, more criminalization and more entrapment will only boost the mass incarceration hellhole that we're in right now. So, and for those listening, because this is the first episode where we are sort of at least about to go into the Israeli-Palestine conflict, BDS stands for Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions. I just want to make sure we keep that educational and don't assume everyone knows what BDS stands for, although I hope you do. Which sort of leads me to the next part of the interview I wanted to get into, which is your documentary work. I watched a few of your videos and they're really, really fucking good. Like, thanks. I want to just give you credit for really great camera work as well as interviews. Two of them that really struck out, though, the first was No Man's Land, which discusses the Israeli Panthers, a facet of history that I have always found very fascinating and intriguing. And you gave me a kind of a very interesting entry point into learning about the Israeli Black Panthers. The other is The Children Who Live Under Israelis' Missiles. Again, just really great work. So if you could first discuss No Man's Land, and then we'll get into the second part as well, second documentary.
Okay, so No Man's Land was a documentary that I shot in 2016 at this point, and it follows this really amazing activist named Ruben Abergel. He's was born in Morocco to a Jewish family who immigrated to Israel when he was pretty young. And from his arrival in, you know, Jerusalem, his family was placed by the Israeli government in the bombed out houses of Palestinians in an area that was on, like, right next to the armistice line between territory that was held by Israel and territory that was held by Jordan. So, like, at this point, what is now considered the de facto, so between the what's the West Bank and what is, like, what some people will call Israel proper or 48 Palestine. So he grew up in this border area where he was constantly exposed to violence and shooting from, you know, the different forces at play there. He was in a community that was completely neglected, where kids would just get kicked out of school really easily and then be on the street and from there be rounded up, put in prison, usually with adults, in a really dangerous, unhealthy, traumatic situation. From this community of Jewish folks from the Middle East and North Africa who were discriminated against because culturally they had so many, you know, they were a lot of, in many cases, Arab and had cultural connections, linguistic connections with Palestinians that were really threatening to this idea of Jews and Arabs being diametrically opposed. So out of these communities came in the 70s a really vibrant protest movement that was saying, basically just demanding basic human rights and dignity for people who have been living in, really just used as a buffer by the Israeli government against Palestinians and also completely neglected from Israeli society. And so this film kind of follows him going through this former Palestinian neighborhood that he grew up in, talking about, you know, oppression and resistance to that oppression that he experienced in his lifetime. And also making, I think, a really important critique of Zionism that we don't hear a lot in the United States, mostly because these conversations are happening in Hebrew and Arabic, that, you know, this was a ideology that excluded Jewish people who are not from Europe and unfortunately resulted in what a lot of people term as a cultural genocide, trying to make them conform to this new Israeli identity.
I think one point that's stands out to me is you said that the families of these people were essentially brought into the houses, the homes of dispossessed Palestinians and on that land. And then because they are migrants on that land, they were, I assume, I'm asking really, they were exploited labor and sort of a cheap labor force. So it's almost as if there's not only a immigration aspect, a racial aspect, a settler colonial aspect, but also now a labor aspect where these people functioned on that land as a not only oppressed, but as an extremely cheap and exploited labor force as well.
Yeah, this is a really important point. And outside of Jerusalem, and I think in a lot of what is termed the kind of periphery, areas outside of the sort of like Jerusalem-Tel Aviv corridor in what's now Israel, there were these places called Mabarot, which are transit camps that Mizrahi Jews from the Middle East and North Africa were placed in at the same time that Jewish folks coming from Europe were getting to live in like kibbutzes, which is a kind of collective community based on Israeli like nationalism, which is like another conversation. But in these transit camps, like a lot of times people were pushed into like working in factories, providing cheap labor. You could be punished if you didn't show up to work. You could be punished if you tried to leave these transit camps. And there's a really deep and tragic history of these communities being exploited by sort of capitalist settler economy in Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to point that out because I think that's an often missed sort of aspect of you know, Israelis' invasion or colonization, is that not only is it this outright violence and displacement, but it's creating a huge sort of hyper-exploited labor force as well.
Totally. And I think when you look at the issue of African asylum seekers today in Israel and the different migrant worker communities that are also extremely exploited, you can see the legacy of the same issue is still very much at play.
Well, can you talk about that a little bit? I know that especially Eritrean, the main group is that I know of, at least, is Eritrean immigrants.
Yeah.
Who are just massively, you know, treated horribly, and there was even a bounty put on their head last year for deportation. So can you sort of explain that and your orientation and your work around the issue of African migrants and how they're oppressed in that area?
So there are hundreds of thousands of undocumented people in, like, Israel now. About 36,000, I think, at this point, of those folks are a community of people from mostly Eritrea, as you were saying, also Sudan, and some other African nations who are basically seeking asylum, political asylum in Israel. They're also part of, like I was saying, this much larger undocumented exploited workforce. I'm working on a long-term documentary project with this community right now, sort of documenting their both the oppression that they experience and also their resistance to that oppression through like this protest movement. Basically, there's a really important connection between this community and Palestinians that I think gets missed. And the Israeli government, initially when African asylum seekers came, was pretty neutral on them, almost welcoming in certain instances, and then saw them eventually as a really easy scapegoat to exploit, given the like existence of anti-Black racism in the society, turned and became very hostile towards them. And one of the ways that they criminalized their presence in the state, you know, these folks are seeking asylum, they have a right to seek asylum under refugee accords that Israel has signed. It changed a law from 1952 that was meant to criminalize Palestinians returning. It's called the Anti-Infiltration Law. And they updated it to also criminalize African asylum seekers specifically. And under this law, the punishment for this, for the crime of seeking asylum, has been incarceration in a prison camp called Holot Detention Center, which a lot of my documentary focuses on. It's supposed to be an open detention center, meaning that people are allowed to leave, but they have to check in anywhere from 5 to 3 times a day. And it's in the middle of nowhere on the border with Egypt. So even if you leave, there's nowhere you can go, really. So it's a very isolating, desperate, sad place that people were held in first indefinitely and then for a period, I think, of up to a year and a half. So there's that aspect of this. Also, more recently, the Israeli Supreme Court opened up a way for the Israeli government to just mass deport these people under this law. Fortunately, the mass deportation aspect ended up being struck down because of basically failed political maneuverings by the Netanyahu government. But, you know, there's a really clear connection where these anti-Palestinian laws and really the framework of incitement that has existed in the country since its inception was then turned on this extremely vulnerable and isolated population that doesn't have a lot of the same, you know, decades of struggle to build on or international attention to build on. They're really struggling on their own for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And I know that these instances of sort of anti-African migrant or anti-Black violent actions by Israeli citizens against these migrants is sort of increasing right now. Just a few months ago, there was over a dozen students from South Sudan who were invited by a small university in Israel to study agriculture there. When they got to the town, dozens of members of the town actually blocked the gates and refused to let them in and threatened them, saying that they would be, quote, rapists and drug dealers and murderers. So this is a one-time instance, but it's emblematic of a larger sort of pattern we're seeing rise more and more. And for me, as someone who studies the way that the Israeli government historically and currently has interacted with African governments across the African continent, I find it wildly fascinating because Netanyahu has been essentially going on an apology tour for the past 2 years, trying to win over African heads of states while simultaneously their own people in Israel are being sort of have violence enacted against them.
Yeah, so it's really important when we talk about these things to mention that Israel has diplomatic relationships with like the Eritrean government. This definitely, and also they want to sell weapons to places like South Sudan and other African nations. And so this is definitely coloring this, like you were saying, this attempt to sort of win over the African continent at the same time where Israel is totally exploiting anti-Black racism, where the government and also these kind of fascist groups are exploiting that racism to distract from the the social tragedy actually that's going on in Israeli society. You know, one of the things, I'm working on a short piece that's related to my longer doc that'll come out soon, that is dealing with the kind of relationships between Mizrahi Jewish folks and African asylum seekers. The Israeli government sort of funneled the asylum seekers into this neighborhood in South Tel Aviv, which is a historically Mizrahi Palestinian and like very oppressed community. And they kind of dumped the asylum seekers there and allowed them to be scapegoated for these problems that have really existed for decades at this point. And so there are people who claim to speak for these communities who, you know, kind of raise a rallying cry against these asylum seekers, saying that they're rapists, that they're creating a gender curfew for women on the streets of South Tel Aviv, and that, you know, they're responsible for crimes and all these things. Of course, statistically, that's like actually the opposite of the truth. Like in a lot of countries, asylum seekers are like much less likely to commit crimes than native-born or like local citizens of a country. But that's really besides the point, because really what this is about is exploiting anti-blackness to distract from the lack of social services, the way these communities have been ignored and are now being gentrified. And so you'll see, unfortunately, some of these groups claiming to represent these communities harassing asylum seekers and their children, especially. Like there's a lot of language around demographics that's really similar to how Palestinians are demonized, because like there are a generation of asylum seeker children who are born in Israel. That's the only country they know. But from the perspective of these really hardcore racists, these kids are destabilizing the Jewish nature of the state, which of course, like even if you accept that, which you shouldn't, numbers wise, that's just a complete farce. But it's really about keeping up this idea of hegemony, which is it's harmed Palestinians, it's harmed Mizrahi Jews, it's harmed even the people who are supposed to benefit from Zionism. And now it's being wielded against really the most vulnerable people who, you know, they're only in Israel because the other option was like going through Libya, you know? They didn't want to be there.
In Libya, where there's now an open slave market, thanks largely to the U.S., of course. But so, and I think that one of the ways in which I've seen racist, conservative, and fascist sort of Israeli pundits speaking about African migrants and Palestinians reminds me a lot of the Jim Crow South rhetoric, where there were anti-conspiratorial laws where if they would say something like, if more than three Black people are in conversation together on the street, they're breaking the law. And essentially, they didn't want people, quote unquote, ganging up or even talking in groups, because they were afraid that they would all suddenly realize they're all being oppressed the same way and revolt or make some kind of change. And I've heard a lot of this similar rhetoric used on Palestinians who aren't allowed to gather, even in groups of five in some places. African migrants moving into a working class neighborhood who are now seen as a threat if they're in large groups, and you know the population or the demographics will overturn. I mean, this is the same rhetoric we hear in the U.S. right now, where white men are terrified that they're going to be the minority for the first time.
Yeah.
Where in reality, globally, they are, and they have been forever.
Yeah, totally. It is really similar.
Definitely. Now, I wanna ask how do Palestinians fit into this? I mean, on one hand, obviously, I understand that African migrants who are seeking asylum and who are fleeing violence, whatever kind of violence it may be, they deserve the right to full human rights. But at the same time, they are going to a place that is on occupied land where there's sort of an active movement against the country that's being waged internationally. So I just want to know sort of how Palestinians feel. You mentioned earlier there's a lot of solidarity or connection between Palestinians and African migrants. And I just want to know what that looks like and sounds like and feels like.
So these communities are, by the nature of the apartheid system, like the asylum seeker communities are living in Israeli society. They're not always having the most contact with Palestinians, although some do work actually in Palestinian businesses and things like this. And this is a really complicated relationship. It's up to the folks who are in a position to talk about these connections. I think it can be really hard and dangerous for both of these communities to make these connections in public sometimes, because there's just like the nature of the incitement against both of them. But there was like a Palestinian letter in solidarity with the asylum seekers saying that, like, and this is from folks, some of whom are Palestinian refugees themselves who have been displaced, saying that like these people they oppose the Israeli government's like use of this settler colonial border to exploit, oppress, and exclude people. There are like also things that are relationships that are not so positive, and you will see or hear asylum seekers in an attempt to justify their presence to Israelis, and really it's a desperate attempt that comes from having their lives being on the line. They'll adopt some of the anti-Palestinian rhetoric. You know, there's also a lot of folks whose only contact with Palestinians was that when they came through the Sinai, many people are held in these sort of ransom, like torture situations by Bedouin folks. And some of those folks would have, when ransom was being demanded from people's families, they would be wiring the money into Israel and like through Palestinian citizens of Israel who are Bedouin and have connections to those folks. So for some people, there's actually a real trauma that makes these relationships very hard. But at the same time, there is like a ton of underground and like less visible support that happens. In my documentary, like one of the most important characters is a Palestinian woman who's working on these issues and just like one of the most principled people, you know, I've ever met. And so, yeah, there are connections, there are tensions, and we have to really remember that like this is the entire system is about divide and conquer rule, and Israel has been like very successful at this. So I think it's up to folks who are coming from a solidarity position and have the ability to advocate for both communities to do that. And also to not, you know, I do get concerned when people are like, well, what are the asylum seekers saying about this? Because they're in a position of absolute desperation and they don't have the privilege of like a blue American passport like I do to say the things that I do. Yeah, these things are really complex. But at the end of the day, it's one system that is affecting all of these people.
Certainly. And I've heard a lot of Palestinians who I'm friends with or who I've listened to in lectures who, I mean, I think it was at the end of last year, you know, there was a list of popular Palestinian activists and artists who wrote that letter of solidarity with African migrants. And there are these public and visible shows of solidarity, like you said, by people who have the privilege of being able to do such. I hope that in the future, those linkages and actions of solidarity can be explored more and sort of documented and historicized.
Yes.
But again, I understand that for both groups, it is a very contentious moment and context which they live in. So switching gears a little bit for the last segment of this interview, I guess I'm going to start having segments in my interviews now. We're covering a lot of ground, and I would love to dive in deeper on every topic. But again, we don't have a 5-hour podcast. We're not trying to bore people here, but I want to touch on sort of Black and Palestinian solidarity. I think that the first time I came in contact with you and your work was on Twitter when you shared an article of mine. And then I clicked on your profile. I was like, oh, this is someone whose work I should definitely know of. And, you know, from that, I've like really enjoyed following you and learning so much from you. Recently, there was the firing of Professor Mark Lamont Hill from CNN, because at the UN, he made statements in support of Palestine, essentially, and he said, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And now, of course, that's said at almost every pro-Palestine protest I've ever been to. It's very common rhetoric, but it was used, and I'm just contextualizing it for people who may be listening and are unaware, but it was used to incite very reductive, very violent sort of craze online against him to end up getting him fired and calling him anti-Semitic. Now, I wanted to get your opinion on that moment and what that means for you as someone who is both Black and Jewish, and then sort of dive into a conversation about the larger history of Black and Palestinian solidarity.
Yeah, so this moment with Mark Lamont Hill, which is extremely frustrating and unjust, you know, where he's, like you said, lost his job for a pretty basic statement of solidarity. It's really just reflective of the attempt to police the conversation around Israel and Palestine in the United States. Also to specifically punish relationships between Black and Palestinian folks, which we've seen happening basically, you know, the relationships are decades long, but this particular attempt by like pro-Israel organizations to attack what they label as like the trend of intersectionality. A lot of this stems from the Ferguson protests where, you know, there was direct solidarity between Palestinians and Black folks that was very visible, I think, for the first time to some people in the United States. So the firing of Mark, it happens at the same time that folks like Linda Sarsour and the Women's March are being attacked, falsely accused of stealing money that they raised for Jewish communities post-Pittsburgh. And it's really just about shutting down that conversation. I think what's scary about it, in addition to the silencing of Palestinians that is so normalized and needs to be really fought at every level, is that this is also taking off the air one of the few voices around that was really giving a critical lens around race and social movements on a platform like CNN. And so we see this like pro-Israel attempt to control one conversation having huge ripples around our whole, you know, issues of representation and justice in the United States. So that's really, really disturbing. And I think, you know, Mark absolutely should be reinstated in his job, although clearly CNN doesn't necessarily deserve him. Yeah, it's just part of this trend we've seen for a long time. An attempt to paint anyone who supports Palestinians as violent, radical, anti-Semitic, in an era where that's just increasingly obvious that it couldn't be farther from the truth. It's totally reasonable to question the idea of sectarian states. No one has to endorse your sectarian movement that only grants rights on the basis of religion. And to act like this is an affront to all Jewish people is to falsely associate every Jewish person with the crimes and human rights abuses of the Israeli government that Mark was rightfully calling into question. And it's also to silence what are growing numbers of Jewish people who want nothing to do with this same system of oppression, who want freedom for Palestinians, and who see that as completely bound up in our own freedom and survival.
I think what's fascinating is that there's a very strong historical precedent for this, specifically when a Black person, whether they're an activist, an artist, a writer, or anything in between, they show solidarity for Palestinians, whether mildly or outspokenly, right? And they're suddenly labeled anti-Semitic. I think that when it happens to a Black person, it's done in this sort of, to me, devious way in which it's attempting to paint that Black person as either violent, like the name Farrakhan has come up about a million times towards Mark Lamont Hill, and there's sort of this wrapping up of this person in this violence for simply expressing solidarity, or there's called ignorant and stupid and said, oh, you just don't know about it. You don't know the complexities of the situation. You just don't understand. You haven't been taught better, which is wildly racist in itself. To me,
both of these things are, and they're rooted in like the kind of the most basic anti-Black stereotypes. Like, mm-hmm. I can't remember who it was exactly. Maybe it was like Reggie Bush or someone put up something about solidarity with Palestinians post Ferguson, and the ADL said you should stick to football, like, which we all recognize now as like a totally racist thing that's wielded against people like Kaepernick and LeBron James when they're talking about racial justice issues. But this was like the ADL a few years ago, a supposedly anti-racist organization, is saying this. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the Farrakhan thing, this is something that like bothers me a lot because, you know, I'm Black Jew, my family's from Chicago, some of my family was former NOI. I'm very familiar with Farrakhan, his rhetoric and his anti-Semitism, you know, queerphobia, misogyny. And it's really like an attempt to associate all Black people with a very extreme image of Black folks. And also at the same time, you know, there are people have connections to Farrakhan because of his role in the community. You know, he shows up in certain places where no one else is showing up. And we can talk about how, you know, I find him truly abhorrent and I would like to never hear about him again. But to like demonize like Tamika Mallory, who had a relationship with him because of like the loss of her father's child, to go after her in this way, try and associate her with the worst things he said, as much as I would love for her to disassociate, it's like really cruel. And it's ignoring the historical context that produces people like Farrakhan and this historical context that he's exploiting, and tries to equate, you know, a kind of a prejudice that does exist in certain corners of the Black community, but is not given the power or force of state violence, with something like structural white supremacy or the structure of apartheid in Israel that fundamentally denies people rights in a way that, as much as I detest Farrakhan and think he's awful, he's not in a position to do that. He's in a position to be really offensive and to stoke dangerous ideas. He's not the same thing as Trump, for example, you know.
Right. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. Anyone who knows me knows it's obvious that I am just very anti-Farrakhan in the sense that I disagree with everything he says and most of what he does nowadays. But people who are not Black or do not have any kind of grasp on Black U.S. history don't understand the role that he did at one time play and the sort of role in the community that the Nation of Islam still plays to this day, but magnificently played, and the hand that they had on our community decades ago. So instant severing of ties with Farrakhan from the community, from people who still want to go to YouTube and listen to his speeches, is a lot more difficult than a lot of people demanding it would really understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's painted as an extremist with state violence power, when in reality, he has the power to be extremely offensive and influentially offensive, which is still, you know, we should still call him out and stuff, but we can't equate that to state violence. To put him in the same sentence as Mark Lamont Hill, someone who does nothing but critique state violence all day long, is a form of racism. It's a form of someone not knowing their history, their theory, or what they're talking about.
Totally.
When we talk about Black and Palestinian solidarity, like with Mark Lamont Hill, it comes from a very long lineage. James Baldwin, for example, he famously wrote that when he traveled to Israel, he felt a great homelessness in his heart, a sense of homelessness, because he understood, in his words, you know, he kind of painted the picture as an Arab and Jewish dichotomy, which is problematic. We can get into that. But nonetheless, he said that what he saw of Israel treating the Arabs, he felt deeply himself from his own adventures in the Jim Crow South. And this was back in 64. We also have Malcolm X, who famously was against Zionism, both in the earlier, more problematic parts of his career and his sort of knowledge and ways of thinking, and later after he came to, in my opinion, be a more well-rounded theoretician. So it's not new, and it's not like Black people haven't been doing the work demanding decolonization of Palestine for decades now.
Our communities have like really long-standing relationships. One of my favorite kind of stories of this is George Jackson, when his cell was raided after his assassination by prison guards. They found a handwritten poem among his personal belongings that many people attributed to him. Years later, it turned out, and this was actually published under his name in Black journals, and years later, it turned out that this was a poem by a Palestinian prisoner named Samuel Qasim. And so, like, we have this incredible back and forth cross-pollination of struggles that's gone on for decades and has been criminalized throughout that entire time. Now there's, like, a really amazing exhibit for George Jackson called George Jackson and the Son of Palestine that's in the Palestinian Prisoners Museum at Queen's University. Yeah.
I have to make a trip to see that.
Definitely. Just being in that space, which is already, you know, a really incredible and important space because of the kind of tribute to the role prisoners play in every society that's in struggle. And then to see this amazing art and recognition of Black political prisoners is just so moving. Mm-hmm. And really speaks to like the depth of the connection between our movements.
I think that what many fail to understand, when there's a singular system that is oppressing many people and many communities differently, but it's still by that same system, right? So if, whether it's the violence of settler colonialism and or capitalism, those connections are almost more difficult to ignore than to make. The same company that makes tear gas that's distributed in Ferguson or Baltimore or Atlanta is the same company used in Gaza and the West Bank. Moreover, a few weeks ago when I was in Matanzas de Cuba, in Matanzas, there's this wonderful, wonderful, like one of the best exhibits I've ever been to, Nelson Mandela sort of historical archive exhibit. And it was actually in an old castle that was built and ran by slaves where they had this exhibit at. So, you know, you get this very just deep emotional feeling walking through it. But they had an entire section and the wall was just filled. And I mean, from inch to inch, every inch of the wall was just filled with posters from the archives of boycott, divest, and sanctions movements for South African apartheid. These were from all around the world, from Germany to India, the US, the UK, calling for people to boycott different companies, different musicians, to go to this concert and raise money for the BDS, anti-South African apartheid movement. The curator of the exhibit, as I was speaking with her, she made sure to mention how similar all of these signs are to the languaging now that is used for the BDS movement in Palestine. You just can't ignore that. You can't ignore that this sort of system of economic exploitation, racial subjugation, and land dispossession are 100% the same sort of systems that we have experienced in the Black community in many different diasporas and within the actual African continent itself.
I mean, it's a history of colonialism that's being resisted, and of course our struggles are using, you know, similar language and frameworks to oppose it, because the language and frameworks that's being imposed on us are so similar. Someone, I think in the aftermath of Mark Lamont Hill's firing, actually posted an image of like the apartheid regime's propaganda against other African nations organizing against it. And it used the same kind of rhetoric of like, oh, these are savages who want to push us into the sea, that we also hear from, that was disattributed to what Mark was saying, that we hear from folks who are trying to demonize any conversation about justice in historic Palestine. And when you look at the systems of policing that are in place in Israeli society, there's a direct connection to the British imperialist police forces in terms of the basic infrastructure of the prisons and the tactics that are used against people, like in terms of torture and pressure that's put on folks that are in that custody. And of course, the British forces that were brought over there were former Black and Tans who were involved in the colonization of Ireland. So, you know, all of these different struggles are deeply connected, and you know, South Africa also has a legacy of British colonialism and imperialism there, as do we in the United States. You know, of course our struggles are going to be connected in sharing imagery and words and support for each other.
I'm currently working on a piece that I hope to have out. It's on the need for both the decarceration and the abolition movements to adopt a decolonial and international lens. In many places where we see prisons in former colonies or neo-colonies, they were actually structures built by the colonizer that are just still functioning and that have now just sort of changed face. In Jamaica, some of our largest prisons we have in Jamaica were built by the British and by the colonialists and the colonizers. The same thing could be said in Hawaii, in Palestine. And so I think we have to think about what these global implications mean for our movements today, because Palestine is very wrapped up in the center of all of this. There's a reason why Mumia Abu-Jamal, Angela Davis, and Alice Walker referred to Palestine as an open-air prison, right? Not only because that is literally what you could describe it as, but because they're trying to connect that language to the language we use here in the U.S. and in abolition movements abroad. If we know we want to abolish prisons, and Palestine is being treated and existing like an open-air prison, then we need to abolish the structures that sort of implicate it that way.
Absolutely.
Sorry, that was a bit of a tangent.
That was great. Yeah, I think that's a good amount of ground that we covered. I'm about to run out of computer battery in probably about 10 or 15 minutes, so maybe we can wrap it up here, but you know, I'd love to continue this conversation some other time and just stay in the loop with each other.
Definitely. I see some ways for us to collaborate in the hopefully near future. And I want to thank you so much for your time. Can you tell people where they can find you at?
So yeah, you can find me on Facebook. I have a Facebook like page that's Rebecca Pierce Films. Just look up Rebecca Pierce Films, you'll find it. Right now that's the best place to get in touch with me and see my work. And there I'll be posting a new YouTube channel, Patreon, and other ways that folks can get in touch and support in the coming weeks.
Sounds good. And I want everybody listening to go check out Rebecca's work, support, support, support. And everyone listening, again, if you like this podcast and you want more of these critical discussions, you can support me at patreon.com/halfatlanta. All right, Rebecca, you have a good day.
You too. Thank you.